Hi everybody, it's Andy Phillips here, and I've got Nariah here, I've got John Richards here, I've got Embers and Rich. Hi everybody, how are you doing?
Hi. Yay! That's not too bad.
Nice cup of tea with the UK atheists.
Good to see you all again. Cups of tea.
And Nariah has got something a little bit stronger by the looks of it.
Cheers, everybody.
What's that you're drinking?
Some rosé.
Oh, very nice.
Out of a plastic cup, though.
I've got my
mug with a hole in it.
Yes, because you've got the green screen on, yes. And today we're going to be talking about apostasy, which is a really, really serious subject. And one that sort of, I don't know whether most people who watch this podcast, but whether they can wrap their heads around it, because it does seem a little bit weird to be penalised for thought. You know, it's that thought police type of crime that we've been having to deal with for a long time. I know both me and John have been working in international organisations. We come across this quite a lot, and it is pretty disturbing at some points as well. So I think the best thing to do is, Nariah, I mean, you've must have had problems with this sort of thing in your life, and you probably know quite a lot of people. What's the actual the biggest problems that people have with this concept of apostasy?
To be honest, I think it stems from, first of all, a lot of people, strictly speaking from an Islamic experience and background, don't even know that, it's a possibility. For example, I didn't even know there was such a thing as apostatizing or kind of checking out of a religion if you don't like it and saying, I want to break away from this ideology, because I just don't believe in its fundamental tenets anymore. So what I require to believe in as a Muslim, I just can't believe in it and I can't say it. So I think the first step is actually accepting internally that this is something you are able to do. And again, thankfully in the West, it is something you are able to do and act on. But as we know, in about 12, 13 countries around the world, you will be penalized for this, you know, if there's the death penalty for it. So I think that's what stops people in its tracks at that fundamental get-go when you're trying to think, okay, is this even something I believe in anymore or something I can abide by? But then the next step is just the absolute backlash that you would get from your immediate community and your family and all those around you, because especially I can't speak for all religions, but coming from, again, the Islamic background, being a Muslim or having that as part of your identity is so built into who you are. And then again, because of I'm of Pakistani background, you know, our entire country was almost built on this migration for giving Islam a name. So it's like, I actually had an existential crisis when I realized, oh, maybe I'm not a Muslim anymore. I'm definitely not a believing one if I want to kind of stay schmutt and still be a Muslim by name. But then where does that leave me? What is my identity? Because how are you Pakistani without being Muslim? Obviously, we have minorities within our country, but I mean, coming from a Muslim background, there's just these layers that you have to shed from the get-go seem almost impossible.
Do you know anybody who's suffered in an attempt to leave Islam?
To be honest, I don't know many people that I'm surrounded by that have gotten to the point where they said, okay, I'm so done with this ideology that I want to call myself an apostate. So the only ones that I've met are after I actually had the guts to leave and then publicly announce the fact that I've left. And then I met fellow ex-Muslims in the UK. That was my first and only contact with other people who thought like me. And before that, it was just Twitter that kind of gave me that final push that there are other people who do think like me and they can say this out loud. Yes. But yeah, otherwise, like even in my own family, even in my own close-knit circle, I am the only person that I know of that's come out and said, this is something I no longer want to be a part of and I will not accept the Muslim tag or label anymore.
Can I ask you if you're having any problems now? You don't need to answer that, obviously.
Yeah, problems in the sense that, like, low-key, I'm always worried, my immediate family is always worried about my safety because I am being quite vocal now with my thoughts, particularly what this religion means for women. So I know there's so many progressive Muslims out there. Most of my family are, I mean, they would never, ever shed the name and the title of being a Muslim, but their lifestyle is kind of, let's say, it goes against some of the basic principles of Islam, but they choose to still stay within that Islamic bubble. So I think for me, the biggest fear I have is my own safety, even in a country like the UK. Obviously, certain parts of the world are completely off limits to me now, and I'd never think about going there. Even though I have family in those parts of the world, I have had to write them off. But yeah, other than that, it's just the main fear is kind of my own security. And I guess just what other people must face as well in terms of like trolls online and the incessant bullying and the incessant kind of desire to shut you up.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. You mentioned death as a sanction. And I imagine that depends where you are. I mean, you were saying that there are areas where you wouldn't go. I guess this is the fundamentalist Islamic theocracies, where they probably do practice death for apostates. But surely there's, in other parts of the world, there might be merely shunning. How does this fit in with the different denominations of Islam?
Yeah, so I would say, obviously, most Islamic countries, by that I mean countries that actually still incorporate Sharia as part of their legal system, there, I mean, it's clear as day, like if you leave religion, you should be killed. So it's the death penalty is the actual charge that would be put on you anyway. And that comes directly from the religion itself, where we have like Islamic sources that says, you know, if one changes their religion, then they must be put to death or kill him, as the prophet of Islam himself said. And actually, there were examples in his lifetime where that actually happened. So in those countries, again, these are countries that I've spent time in and I grew up in, and I will never be able to go back there and kind of, you know, go back to my childhood home or see where I grew up, because it's just too dangerous. The fact that is the legal inaction anyway. But then, as you said, if that's not going to be the end and final result, it is the absolute shunning and the fact that you will be shut down no matter what it is that you try and say. It would be a taboo within your family, within your community, and just by the backlash you could get from your community, your family that may otherwise be understanding and accepting of your kind of way of thinking, they're also just so fearful of the backlash from their own communities because of how much this means. This almost means you're turning your back on absolutely everything you've known, and especially in Islam, when you're born, the first thing that is said to you as a newborn baby is like the call to prayer is whispered in your ear. So like that's the, I guess it's the equivalent of like a baptism or something. But in Islam, we say that so between that call to prayer and then your final funeral prayer being read, that is your entire lifetime. So that's what I mean. The identity seeps so far in that even if people around you are accepting, they will in their own ways try and find ways to beg you to be quiet.
Yeah. I mean, one of the things that I find really interesting about this is, as you say, the way that religion is labeled on somebody, whether they actually believe it or not. And to actually say, well, I'm leaving that, is leaving more, I think it's considered more than just sort of leaving a religion. You know, as you say, you know, when a baby is born within that community, the call to prayer is whispered in the ear, that baby is then labeled as a Muslim, even though, of course, it's a baby. The baby has had no choice. The baby has no cognitive ability to make that decision. So if later in their life they turn around and say, I don't believe this, they're by default an apostate. And that can happen in, you know, every community. I mean, I was baptized at 5 years old. I've never been a believer, ever. I've never believed. Yet I was baptized at 5 years old. Does that make me, in the eyes of the Christian church, an apostate because I was baptized and therefore they claimed me as a Christian? And the fact that I say I don't believe this, have I actually left Christianity? Because as far as I'm concerned, I was never part of it in the first place.
That depends which sort of Christianity. If you were in a Protestant sect, then it's fairly easy to say I'm not going to play this game anymore. But according to the Roman Catholic tradition, there's no way out. You're always on their books. You can say you're not going to play the game anymore, but you don't get crossed off. You're still registered with them. And I think there's other absolute faiths too, isn't there? I mean,
well, if you look at some of the more, should we say, some of the more recent forms. I don't know whether or not to call them Christian or not, but if you look at
if you look at
the Jehovah's Witnesses and the Mormons, shunning of apostates is a duty. And in fact, actually, you know, a lot of families have been torn apart because a lot of families have taken their duty to the religion higher than the duty to their own children. When their children walk away. So again, I think this idea of apostasy, this idea of exercising your own free will, which, you know, they say God gave us. So exercising it, however, is a crime. And I've just looked up the latest. I used to think it was 13. It's now down to 10 because three of them have actually, if we can call this progress, have removed the death penalty.
Oh, result, yeah.
But do they still have punishment for it? If they take, death off the table, which even just discussing this just blows my mind, to be honest. Yes. But off the table, do those countries still have, you know, punitive punishment for that? And for things like blasphemy as well, because blasphemy is part of this whole concept as well. You know, it's not just about just removing yourself from a religion, but there's also this whole thing about blasphemy. And again, it's one of those things that, you know, whenever I deal with any of this stuff, you read something and you just go, this cannot be true. I mean, this, you know, the 21st century, it just cannot be true to be punished for a crime of, say, apostasy. It's of leaving a religion, in other words, just thinking to yourself, actually, I just don't believe this anymore. Mm. And then being threatened with death. Mm. It just blows my mind. The other thing that blew my mind was that, you know, this whole thing about the blasphemy laws, because they sort of interlace with this sort of thing as well.
Well, exactly, because, I mean, leaving is apostasy. If you vocalize, or if you sort of explain your reason for leaving, you've probably then committed blasphemy on top.
Yeah, definitely.
Well, sort of by default, I guess.
By default, yeah.
And it's interesting that in these Islamic countries anyway, the blasphemy isn't technically for God or Allah himself, it's actually against the Prophet. So it's just the man that represents the religion. It's almost like God is still debatable in your private spheres, but the second you say something against Muhammad, that's it. You know, you could be incarcerated, you could be facing all of these legal penalties. And obviously there's different stages to it. So they do technically, they're supposed to give you like 3 days to repent and then kind of invoke Islam again. So you recite what you need to become Muslim, and you would say that you've kind of mended your ways and you've changed, and that was just, you know, the devil or whatever coming in and corrupting your mind. But yeah, it's interesting that it's not even God that they're trying to safeguard here. It's the man with the message that you cannot absolutely say anything against. You can't draw a picture. You can't say a comment. And again, it's like this, the way you were saying, Andy, that you're shocked this happens in the 21st century. It's even more shocking how politicized this tool is. The fact that blasphemy is just used to kind of, you know, you have, especially in a country like Pakistan, for example, if you have a Christian neighbor that you kind of want to teach a lesson to, you just make a, you know, you could send a dodgy WhatsApp message and claim that they've said something back that you don't like. You could leave a Quran in their house and say, oh, look, they've not put it on the right level. They've put it one level below. They're disrespecting the holy book. And this person could be at the mercy of the law for something as basic as that, from drinking from the same well as fellow Muslims. Anything can be misconstrued as blasphemy in these countries where it exists.
Yeah, that's really, really sad, because there have been thousands and thousands of cases of that. People just accusing people without any foundation whatsoever. Even without foundation, dear me, you know, what? It's just absolutely appalling.
It's almost like weaponizing religion in a very insidious way against your neighbour.
Definitely. And when it seeps furthermore even into politics, you know, when they kind of use religion as a reason to shut down political opponents by saying they're not religious enough, or this politician has supposedly said X, Y, and Z against the Prophet, therefore we will censor them off all of these social media platforms. It's just a form of political censorship, but you're using religion to be your tool and to kind of get the public behind you. So to win public approval, religion is the easiest thing to do in these countries.
Yeah, but Nora, you were saying that you know, there's a, you know, in some places there's a 3-day you know, window for you to say your regrets, etc. But we know from the media that we see people accused of blasphemy, and they're literally dragged out of their homes by their neighbours and beaten to death within minutes. Yeah. Of this by a baying mob. That's just horrible. Yeah.
Again, that's the thing. When you say that somebody has offended or said something against, I mean, this is why I think Islam is so problematic from like the fundamental scriptures itself, because even like the Prophet says, you know, nobody has loved me until he has loved me more than his own siblings and parents, so that he is regarded as being like above even your own mother and father. So then if you've got any kind of random Tom, Dick and Harry that has supposedly, allegedly said something, mob justice ensues and they basically take it into their own hands, and the public like laps it up and applauds them, and these people are cheered on as heroes, and if they happen to die as part of this, they are given the hero's funeral as opposed to that, you know, the poor person who was murdered extrajudicially. So sometimes it doesn't even have to go to court. It's just these punishments are meted out by the public themselves, because they feel like having your feelings hurt is enough to take somebody else's life in the name of religion.
Narai, why do you think I know we see things on British media, BBC, etc. Why do you think people get so inflamed about this? Why do people mob on the streets about, you know, one person who's actually done something? And it may be different if you're actually there and witnessing it. But the things we see on, say, the BBC News, it just baying mobs of aggressive males on the street, never females. Aggressive males. What is whipping them up? Why are they so angry about this?
Well, I think again, this comes down to I could never understand this as well until I had like done a deep dive into the scripture and then realized this is what gives them so much ammunition. The fact that there are, you know, the wording is such that you will not love the Prophet, you will not show your loyalty, you have not shown your dedication, you have not, you know, almost put yourself in a situation to be a martyr for Islam until you're defending the cause. So there's various types of jihad, which is, you know, the war to the holy war. But going against the Prophet is almost like it's so below the belt. And these men, these young men who are aware of their sources in scripture and know what it says and know what is demanded of them, they know that one of the most, you know, one of the biggest things that is considered sacrilege is going against the man or saying anything against him. So if you want to shed light or doubt the authenticity or the kind of this perfect man who was meant to be the eternal example for humanity, and you just mention something as little as, why did he marry a 6-year-old? You know, why did he not essentially ban slavery? He had and traded sex slaves of his own. But you're crossing a line there. And these men know that even living in the West, for example, this is a way for me to showcase my identity and for me to take part in this holy war. And they're fully aware of what their scriptures say. And again, I mean, we see this happening even in England, which is so sad. But some of these Islamic societies and the universities and these imams at these mosques, they really don't hold back with this aggressive rhetoric that they kind of push forward. So we have a Friday prayer called Jumma, and before that, there's like a sermon held. And even in these sermons, you can see the rhetoric being like, do not ever let anybody say anything against the Prophet. Like, this is your duty. This is your duty. to you as a Muslim to uphold his honor. And so it's all so internalized to the fact that they think they need to take matters into their own hands.
Mm. Yeah. Well, a couple of weeks ago, I reported on a woman, this is for blasphemy, not apostasy, who was sentenced to death in Lahore, I think it was. But that wasn't enough. As well as sentencing her to death, they fined her 250, I don't know how much, I can't find the price that she was enacted, but it seems to me a bit over the top.
We're it's just rubbing salt into a wound, price. Honestly. Beating a dead horse, yeah. I mean, yeah. These are probably, these people are already, I mean, this woman, I think she was an academic, but usually they come from such a, you know, a more poorer background, and to add a fine on top of a death sentence that they are going to have to fight, yes. If any lawyer is first and foremost willing to take on that, because by taking on that case, you basically take on the entire public and pretty yes. much the government and pretty much the judiciary as well. And so you're concerned for your own safety. Sometimes you don't make it, and you do get killed at the hands of, you know, this kind of mob justice army that unleashes themselves. But yeah, it's almost ridiculous. I mean, they don't consider anything in this woman's case, for example, you know, Joseph Smith would have suffered this exact same fate had he been there at the same time. But they don't consider mental health as a factor. They don't consider, you know, people having their own grievances against this woman. They don't consider these things. It's just what she has said or what she has proselytized is enough.
So why do we think that religions need to have these punishments, these crimes? I'm using my fingers to do the quotation marks, and horrible sanctions like death. Why do we think they do that?
I think there's a couple of reasons. The first one is they don't want to lose their own numbers. It's a self-defense mechanism in terms of if people walk out, they'll lose their power. But also, and especially with some of these more modern cults, they don't want people to actually, who were on the inside, to tell their stories once they get out of some of the things that actually go on, which maybe the wider public don't know about. And of course, I think one of the great things about the internet now is it's given a platform to those people, those apostates that have left, how to tell their story and reveal some of the really nasty things and horrible things that go on behind those closed doors.
Yeah.
You know, the stories that you hear, certainly in the Jehovah's Witness and the Mormon, from the Mormon communities, some absolutely horrendous stories of abuse, of power dynamics, of bullying, or worse, that seem to go on behind those closed doors. Apologies, I've just got ambulance going by. They're coming to take me away.
It's no wonder they don't want that sort of shameful. What would you call it? The dirty linen. They don't want that linen, do they?
But again, I mean, as we've said, but it's to protect their power. It's to protect power. As it always comes down to, it's power and control. And you know, that's been topics that have come up. You know, most of our podcasts that we've done comes down to power and control of people.
We have a lot of crossover in our podcasts, don't we? And I did some research for this today. I've known about apostasy, obviously, a very, very long time, because I've been an atheist all my life, never had any religious belief at all. But I was surprised to see that one of the Christian organisations who shun people, should we just use that as a polite word? Let's just use shun, not stoning to death or anything like that, but shun, was the Salvation Army, which, you know, we see as a benevolent charity in the UK. I was really surprised to see that at all. But atheists don't have this problem. I've always been an atheist. I've never been part of any organisation to do with religion. So I don't have any problems with leaving an organisation because I was never part of it in the first place.
I think this is the key, though, isn't it, Embers? You know, and I've said this before, but I think that I've lived in a very cozy little bubble in the UK through my life. Like you, I mean, I used to go to church with my parents and things like that, but I was never really a believer. And it wasn't until I started to be more sort of active in atheist movements that I suddenly realized that my life is very, very simple. When I decided just not to go to church, I just decided not to go to church. My mum said, "Are you going to church?" And I said, "No, I don't believe in God. I'm not interested in going to church anymore." And she went, "Oh, okay then." You know, and that is how basically it should be. I mean, and I've had conversations with my mum about this over the years because she's a believer, but it was always like you follow your heart, you follow what you know. If you want to believe in God, you can believe in God. If you don't, then that's your life, you know. But what I'd noticed is since I've been sort of being more active in this, and I've taken more notice about the TV programs that have been on and things like, you see people like Richard Dawkins in the old days being interviewed, and he would often ask maybe an imam that's come on, and he will ask them, what is the penalty for apostasy? And these apologists that have come on TV, I mean, not talking about just Islamic apologists, but in this case about apostasy, it was an Islamic apologist, would not answer, would not give a straight answer that it is death. The penalty is death. He wouldn't actually say that because what
he knew the audience would
happen is that they try and soft or make it as soft as possible to try, almost like they try and fool the West. Oh no! It's, you know, there's things that can can happen, but is it death? And this is what Richard Dawkins. But what is the penalty for apostasy? And they wouldn't answer it. And the other thing I've noticed is that when you get people who talk about Islam, who are still believers but aren't actually apologists, they almost have a completely different view from the apologist. They have a view of Islam that is beautiful and sweet and lovely. And when they're asked anything about things like blasphemy, apostasy, any of those difficult subjects, they don't really understand it. They don't really know that. And so they're still doing apologetics, but they're doing it from a position of ignorance almost. They don't really understand that. They have never really seen that. And it's just very interesting that there's this cognitive disconnection somehow between what practicing Muslims think Islam is and what apologists know what it is and defend it by smoke screens. Yes. I mean, has anybody found that? Is that just me?
No, can I just jump in there, Andy? We're talking about Muslims and Islam. Let's just use the term Muslim. They're not a homogenous group.
No.
Just like Christians, there are people who are cultural Muslims, there are people who are cultural Christians. They don't go to church, they don't, cultural Muslims don't go to the mosque. They observe the traditions. All the Muslims I've met are really, really nice people.
Mm-hmm.
Obviously, I've never been to Afghanistan with the Taliban, but all the Muslims I've met are absolutely fantastic people. You have to be careful,
Absolutely.
And there are different
groups. One could almost call them, to use the westernized phrase, denominations of Islam. And there's even a couple of those that actually, I mean, I was just reading there was one group that absolutely condemns the idea of death for apostates. Mm-hmm. So again, it's not universal. But then again, as a sect of Islam, they have actually come under fire from other Muslims for being apostates themselves, for not believing in that. It's
not three Scotsmen.
Naraya, you were about to say something.
Yeah, no, I just wanted to say that. No, I think you hit the nail on the head there, Andy, with your kind of like, this is exactly what happens, right? So you see, in a way, they are trying to, I wouldn't like fool the West, yes, but they're trying to, if not fool, they're trying to like present this heavily sanitized version of Islam, which because they know the penalties, these are scholars and they know what their actual books say. And then, like you said, speaking for the rest of them who out of their own sheer ignorance, I was just as ignorant. I did not equate leaving Islam to somebody being put to death. But that's also because I was ignorant of the fact that one could leave Islam in the first place. So the very first time I heard the term ex-Muslim, not even the term actually, I just met a man who at university said, I was a Muslim and I no longer am one. And I thought he was crazy. I was like, you're a loony bin, mate. How can you even leave this? Like, you might not like it, but you can't leave it. And so it was only until like people like Mariam Namazi, who actually went on mainstream media and, you know, I saw the word ex-Muslim underneath that, I was like, oh my God, there's people out there who actually are moving away from this. And most people don't know the fact that the punishment is death. The only reason that my family were kind of brought into like awareness of the fact that my life is now potentially in danger is because they've now put two and two together from the scripture itself. But otherwise, you are kind of just living in your own bubble and you're only fed this nice, peaceful, fluffy Islam. You'll never know the true penalties. And then, sorry, just one last thing, John, real quick, is because there are different schools of thought, there's the one that I think a lot of South Asia follow is the Hanafi school of thought. I was reading, and I'm not sure, I haven't verified this, but the scripture actually said that the punishment for men, unless they repent in 3 days, is death. But the punishment for women, that leaving Islam, there was none because they couldn't imagine that a woman would ever leave. And that blew my mind. I was like, wow, you actually think that no woman is capable of saying, I am done with this ideology, that there's no punishment there. But just as you said, as well, it's not a homogenous group. So that's why.
Are women even people?
Just property, I'm afraid.
Well, I agree with Embers in that there's a lot of different shades. This is not a black and white thing. I actually live with a member of my household who is, on his passport, it says he's a Muslim. He's Turkish, and I take him to work every day and bring him back every afternoon. He's a nice guy. And what we have here is a religion which tries to capture you at birth when you can't make an informed decision. But then once you're in their net, it won't let you go. So there you are. You're trapped. And I know somebody else who also wasn't a religious man in any sense at all, who applied for a passport to come here, if he was coming from Kurdistan. And when he opened his passport, that's when he found out, he said, I'm a Muslim. So
Why would you put your religion in a passport?
No, he didn't put it in.
Why would a religion be in a passport? It's not. Mm. It's not a piece of information that's needed in a passport.
Exactly.
No. It doesn't appear in a passport. Not in the UK, certainly.
Not in the UK, no. But as you say, Turkish, Kuwaiti. Oh.
Yeah.
The strange thing is, we look at this and we're you know, from our sort of, I don't know, our UK eyes, you know, now we are naive sometimes when we look around because we don't really sort of, we have not experienced the things that other countries, some of the, you know, the sort of the other countries have. But when you look at something like blasphemy, and you've got to remember that the blasphemy law, even in the UK or in England and Wales, came out, what was it, 2008 or something like that? Wasn't it this year they actually took the blasphemy law away? Was it 2021?
It was only a few years ago in 1992.
No prosecutions had been made for half a century.
No, because they probably looked at it and said, it's just someone thinking something. You know, it's like, we're never going to make this stick.
It's also, it is also incompatible with international human rights legislation.
But this is the other thing I was going to talk about, Rich, you know. This whole thing about the human rights side of it, you know, how can it still be going on when people are signing up to, you know, these human rights declarations?
I mean, if you look at the UN International Declaration of Human Rights, there is a clause in there that basically says every person is entitled to follow the religion of their choice, and that they are also free to change religions if they wish to do so, or to leave a religion if they wish to do so. This is the United Nations Declaration of Human Rights. This isn't even say like the Human Rights Act in the UK or the European Declaration, the European Convention of Human Rights, which are always under attack in this country by ignorant people. But this is the United Nations. Mm. And you've got the situation, we've got a representative from Saudi Arabia chairing the United Nations Human Rights Commission.
Not anymore. I think that did happen.
But no, that did happen, yeah.
Yeah.
But you also have the usual suspect countries that we mentioned earlier, who are trying to lobby to make blasphemy and apostasy illegal on an international basis and remove that clause from the Universal Declaration.
Mm. Oh, that pressure has been on from, I'll guess which religion that is, for the last 20 years at least, pressure on Europe Council. So it's just ongoing. It really is relentless.
Mm. I've just looked up the word apostasy, and it comes from a Greek word, apostasis, which means runaway slave.
Wow.
Now there's a great origin story for a word.
Yeah.
I did not know that at all. I did not know that. I didn't thought about looking up the word. Listen, guys, I think we've sort of covered quite a lot in this. And I guess if you've been watching this, listen to this, or you've got any questions or any comments, then we'd love to hear that, what your opinion is on this whole thing. Any last words?
I'd just like to hear from our people from out there who've experienced it. And I would love to hear their stories if they are willing to share them with us. That would be fantastic.
Yeah, and literally you can come on the podcast and talk about it if you feel comfortable in doing that. So if it's happened to you, then yeah, please come on and we can discuss that.
I'm going to do what Rich normally does then, which is, what are we going to do about it?
Mm. Yeah, but this is the biggest problem, because, you know, it's this impotency. You know, there's we can't do anything about any other countries. We can only do what we do in the UK, and it's about all you can do. But you can support things like, you know,
support those organisations that are able to support those who have left. You know, there's very little that we as an organisation can do, but we can lend our support to groups like the Council for Ex-Muslims, for example, whose job is to try and... Humanist UK, those that actually have the infrastructure to actually physically help some of these people who are basically in danger as a result of their apostasy. But also, we can be there as friends to support those that wish to leave and give them the encouragement and a safe space to land.
Mm. Okay, a final word for me, very quickly. Go to the atheismuk website.com and look on resources, and you'll find two drop down tabs. One is about asylum, and the other one is about leaving religion. There's a lot of information there that will help you.
Yeah,
and we put links below the video and below the podcast to actually go to that as well.
And today I was notified by AAI, your
Atheist Alliance International.
Yeah, yes, Andy and my old stamping ground, that there's a person seeking asylum arriving at Gatwick Airport, or has just arrived at Gatwick Airport, and is there anything we can do to support them? So I'm willing to go and meet this person and find out.
That's brilliant, John.
Yeah. Nariah, anything from you?
Yeah, just a quick word on what Rich was saying earlier about it's a powers game for a lot of these religions, or whatever you'd like to call them. And I just think that as the topic today was apostasy, I think the numbers that are reflected in terms of people leaving religion, if apostasy laws and blasphemy laws were to be taken out of the equation, the numbers would be far more dramatic than what we'd ever assume. So we know there are a lot of you out there, and the only reason you're not able to come forward and speak and speak your truth is because of those laws in the first place. But as you all said, you know, please come forward. There's organizations out there. We'll all help in whatever small way we can. But yeah, it's got to go in the 21st century. It really does.
Yeah.
Thank you, Nora. Yeah.
Brilliant.
Thank you all. Thank you so much.
Yeah, thank you. And we're going to be back next week with another episode. So if you like what we talk about and are interested and want to comment, do all those sort of things, but also subscribe to the channel. And we'll see you all next week. See you later.
Bye.
Bye.
Well, thanks for joining us today. And don't forget to click that like button. Also, make a comment. And, of course, subscribe to the channel. We'll see you next time.